You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website rickackerman.com. Are you speaking to us from Florida anymore?
Anymore I am, yes. I was just ready to leave Florida, having suffered one hot summer too many, and then someone was selling a two-bedroom place for, like, nothing, so I decided to stick around. I was going to rent here, but I'm going to stay the winter.
Going up to New Jersey, New York area in the winter, maybe not the best anyway?
No, I love New Jersey in the winter. You know, when I grew up there, the Atlantic City was so desolate in the winter that you really had the run of the place, you know, that the kids would sneak in. We thought we were sneaking into the game room at the Traymore Hotel and the other places, but it turns out the porters were so desperate for company that even the bratty little kids who used to come in there in the winter, they welcomed the company.
Oh, excellent. Rick, let's kick off our show with a listener question. Last time on the show, you mentioned your investor friend who's never wrong on his big investment calls. Rick said he had recently sold all of his precious metal holdings and gone all in on treasuries. Rick also said the investor friend was a deflationist, but then said he expects interest rates to go higher. Isn't this a contradiction?
Not really. Let me first say about my friend, he just always gets it right. He was a clerk on the exchange when I first knew him, but he later came to own office buildings, and he cleverly bought buildings where he had good anchor tenants like Starbucks. But he sold his commercial properties exactly at the top 2 or 3 years ago, and he's been accumulating 5,000-ounce bars of silver for years and years and years, and he bought them all the way down to, I don't know, $14, and he's sitting on huge profits, but he cashed out of silver and gold, and he's going into treasuries. So the listener's question concerned, you know, how is that in a deflation, what happens? And the listener was focused on, well, the question was, why does your friend really want to buy bonds with all of the, if you're a deflationist? But what you need to look at is not the nominal interest rate, but the real rate. So in a deflation, you could have interest rates falling, which is the same as saying if you're invested in treasury paper, you're going to make money. During the big inflation, non-inflationary years of the 1980s, 90s, and the aughts, there were years when investors in treasuries made capital gains of 15% to 25%. All right, and that sort of, people say, "Oh, well, you know, why do you want to buy bonds at X percent?" And the fact is that even though the yields may sound small, the capital gains potential is enormous because, of course, bond prices rise. They correlate inversely with interest rates. So falling interest rates send the prices of your bonds higher, and that translates into relatively large gains for small moves, downward moves in interest rates. So to come full circle here, it's the real burden, the real interest rate that's important, not nominal. So rates could fall to 2%, but if we had similarly to 2007 and 2008, if the underlying collateral value, in other words, housing prices, are falling, then 2% is a huge burden on debtors. So that's what we're really looking for in a deflation. Even with falling interest rates, in real terms, those 2% or 3% rates could be, they could be crushing.
So would you stay in precious metals, or is it time to swap them for bonds, as your friend has done?
Well, coincidentally, my friend exited at a Target that I've been drumrolling since September in Comex Gold. The Target interpolating for the change of months, but it was 2803.40 cents. And that was basis the December COMEX contract. And the contract several weeks ago topped at 2801.80, I think it was. So I missed by $1.60, but it's come down several hundred points since then. You know, gold, it's about ready to sell off $300 from where I had this top nailed. And I couldn't have told you then, and I can't tell you now, whether that was going to be the end of the bull market in gold, but it's possible. I don't think so. I think that if we get a move above the old high at 2801, that we're going to hit 2990. That would be my next target, but at least we were not taken by surprise when gold made this what has so far has proven to be a quite significant top just above 2800.
Now, taking a look at what could possibly happen under the new Trump administration, positive moves, and will this record high stock market continue?
Up to a point. I think it's been a little bit overdone. The fact is that Trump, even though statistics give you all this happy bull twaddle about we're in a boom, we're not. We're in the usual asset boom. Maybe 80-85% of Americans don't feel like we're in any kind of boom. You know, it's an asset boom, and of course the rentiers have done really well. But it's not a real boom. So Trump is inheriting kind of, let's call it a set of cooked books, and he can brag about it. But if it's sustained for any length of time, but really it's no more, it doesn't go any deeper than a stock market that is in nutso mode. You know, the market is just going up. Alan Newman, a friend of mine from the forecasting world, he puts out a letter called Cross Currents, and Alan has been as perma-bearish as I am, but I see that Bitcoin has finally brought him around. He's got this idea that that Bitcoin, the inflation in Bitcoin, which is many, it's like hundreds of billions of dollars, $300 or $400 billion, $500 billion, has liquefied or provided liquidity for the stock market. So he's linked the two together, and all of us perma bears have something like that, a kind of point of reckoning where we're thinking, well, there's got to be a reason for this, and I'm happy to report that Alan has found Bitcoin as a reason, as a source of liquidity for the stock market. So the stock market, I think Trump can work miracles with respect to his promises to purge deep state, to send them all to the guillotine if necessary. And I think he can do a lot of great things there. But the economic cycles are bigger than presidents. Whatever presidents do, or whatever they say they're going to do, there are only two kinds of things that happen with if you're president, and they both depend on, it's a matter of luck. So if you're unlucky, you're George Bush, the first George Bush, and you're seeking re-election as the country sinks into recession, then, well, it's bad. But if you're, let's say, Bill Clinton, and being elected right around the time when cyclically an upswing was ordained, well, Bill Clinton got lucky. So all presidents are, no matter how grandiose their ideas or even how valid their ideas, they don't have any impact. They don't have much impact on the economy. They can affect the stock market, which does its usual lunatic-y thing. But a president really doesn't affect the broad economic cycles. So we're so advanced in the boom cycle that it's reasonable to infer that Trump is, he's really going to be in an economic mess within a year or two.
How's that going to sit with the voters? Or, of course, he doesn't have to worry because he won't be running again. Or will he?
Well, the people are stupid enough, the same people who have bought the Dow up to 40,000, to believe that if the economy did turn down, it would be all Trump's fault. And, of course, the Democrats won't lose any time trying to make that case, even if the economy, meaning the stock market, starts to slide before Trump is inaugurated, the Democrats will figure out a way to blame Trump for that. It'd have to be a pretty clever idea, but that's what they'll do. So if Trump is, let's say, 6 months to a year into his second term, and the crash that we all know is going to happen happens, then for sure he'll get the blame. So that's the way it works.
Mm-hmm. Of course, then it makes them a lot harder for the Republicans to get in next time, or do you think they will?
Even if there is a crash. I'm so fed up having to think about the 2024 election and, you know, all these idiots who make their living pretending that there's something to talk about politically, they're already starting to work on the 2028 election and you know, why Nikki Haley's current strategy, it may work out for her to distance herself from Trump because she'll run better and harder in 2028. But it's a sickness of America that's sort of pushed on us by the hacks who create the news, who invent the news, that we somehow need to be thinking about the 2028 election. I mean, for all the predicting and punditing and everything else, those jagoffs couldn't even produce, they couldn't even predict what was going to happen a day before the election. And as it turns out, most of them got it very wrong.
I would love it if they just stopped talking politics and started covering the news again.
It's too hard to cover the news because then you have to do digging. You know, in the old days, we had to go down to the Records Bureau and dig up records and go to planning board meetings and things like that. But the young crusaders who graduate from Northwestern and University of Missouri and some of our formerly esteemed journalism schools, they got nothing better to do than try to, you know, be heroes to make this a better world. So they can't be bothered by covering the news. So that's why things that sort of write stories that write themselves or get the most coverage, and one of those is politics and the other, of course, is weather.
Yeah, just send somebody to the nearest storm and have them stand there and get battered around as roofs fly around them. But as we say, that's the kind of news that makes its own gravy. There's not a lot you have to do. Look, it's windy and rainy.
In practice, they all sit around sometimes in the same location. They're drinking coffee and they're waiting for just one thing. The weather story is focused on one thing, and that is death. They need one person to die, and if it's there's a Chicago blizzard and one person shoveling snow and he dies of a heart attack, then they get to call it a killer storm, a killer blizzard in the headline. So virtually every weather story is dependent on that death. They're all sort of praying for someone to die as a result of something that can be tied in some way to the weather. So I know that because I was a reporter out of college. I worked for a small 100,000 circulation paper, mid-sized paper, and one of my first assignments on the rewrite desk was to write the weather ear each day.
Well, all you get right now for reporting is they read government news releases. They don't question the person who sent it out, ask them, why are you doing this? What are you covering up? Nobody does that. They just read the government news release like that is a fact.
Right. There's no digging, really. And I can tell you exactly when and why it happened, because I was fortunate to have been born in 1949, and everything that happened to our group. So we had the student strikes in 1969, and the country went berserk over Vietnam, and the thing that turned journalism in the wrong way was the whole Woodward Bernstein thing. Nixon eventually resigned for a crime that wouldn't even make the police blotter, politically speaking, these days. You know, Nixon did nothing except piss off the press for a lot of years, but the whole Watergate scandal, it didn't amount to anything, really, not compared to what Hillary Clinton, for one, might accomplish in a couple hours of perfidy, treachery, betrayal, deceit. She's a constant, continuous felon. So Nixon wouldn't even get on the radar of things that measure the current daily scandals. So with the whole Watergate thing, the kids started going to journalism school wanting to make the world safe for democracy. So they all became crusaders instead of reporters. And that's where journalism took a very wrong turn, with Watergate.
Well, it perhaps taught people to dig, but all of the people who learned how to dig and weren't embarrassed to ask tough questions have all been, as I say, retired. You're now retired, whether you want to be or not.
Yeah, and when you see the game that gets played, like if you watch the White House press conferences with Corinna What's-Her-Face, she's the worst role model you could have for going and asking questions. You get the impression nothing happens at the White House press conference. So why should it happen in your local planning board meeting?
The late Brian Mulroney, Canadian Prime Minister, he was always famous for saying, "How dare you ask that question?" And I said to him, "I dare, and I'd appreciate an answer." "Oh, well, okay." Politicians take lessons in how to intimidate journalists who do ask tough questions. Just stand your ground and ask the question. Also, somebody sends out a news release, "We're not going to provide any interviews or answer any questions." I say, "Well, then that's just propaganda. So if you want me to run that, you better buy an ad and say that, because if I can't question you, it's not news." And yet people say, "Well, they just sent this statement." That's not news, folks. That's propaganda. So that's where the whole, plus though, they've laid off. Every newsroom is empty. You go in there, they used to be full of reporters. The Vancouver Sun and Province don't even have a newsroom anymore. The reporters work from home. So you don't have that synergy of discussing, you know, what are the big stories? What have you found out? What have you heard? None of that goes on anymore. That's why big companies want people to come back to the office, because that water cooler chat is actually productive.
It is. It is. I have a good idea. I templated it and started to do it in Boulder before I moved to Florida. The idea was to revive hard-hitting local journalism. And, it has there are a lot of people, groups going at that now, but they're all sort of ass backwards because they're all sort of looking for funds for handouts, and there are plenty of handouts. New Jersey, I think, established a $5 million fund for anybody who had an idea to help local papers. And, of course, California, it's happened in a big way with a billion-dollar bequest from one of the Silicon Valley lefties it's $1 billion for journalism, but you can imagine what kind of journalism that's going to be if it comes from the hard left. There is a question, really, of whether the younger generation will ever again read papers. They get all their news now from TikTok, and the power has diffused considerably. You know, the main media outlets don't really hold sway the way they used to. And you could say that they didn't affect, if they affected the election at all, it was with their relentlessly bad coverage that drove people away from the narrative, which was orange man bad. So I wonder whether we have a situation where the big papers still sort of determine the agenda and they create the milieu. The milieu is red state, blue states, they're at war. America is at war with ourselves, and red hates blue and blue hates red. But at the local level, it's not that way at all. You know, a local paper has the potential to give the best thing a small paper can do is give a community a sense of itself, to give people a common purpose, and of course to show them what's possible when people work together. If you're at a PTA bake sale and you don't really care if you're raising money for the library whether the person on your right or left is conservative or liberal or whatever. So I think the only road back for this country is through the revival of small town papers, and there's a way to do that without spending much money. Certainly not going to the Pew Foundation for grants or things like that. But it's the template that I was rolling out in Boulder was a way to make it pay for itself from the very beginning, starting with what would not be hard news coverage, but it would be the kind of coverage that garners enough eyeballs so you can go out there and sell ads to liquor stores and car dealers. But there is, in my mind, this nagging doubt that young people can be encouraged, inspired, induced to even read newspapers anymore. But the whole art of writing local news and also appreciating it seems to have gone by the wayside.
We'll have more with Rick Ackerman right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Rick Ackerman. Rick, NVIDIA still at the top of the board. Such a high valuation. Is it a good buy still, or was it ever?
I'm in a little bit of a quandary about that. You know, I think AI is a complete fraud. It's hyped to death. And I judge, as we've talked about this before, I look at AI as what happens when I try to use voice to text on my phone. The thing can't even get a sentence. It makes 4, 5, 6, 7 errors for every sentence you dictate into it. And if that ain't an iteration of what they call the large language model in AI, then nothing is. So to me, AI is a bunch of, well, it's, if you read, but on the other hand, to the extent that there are a lot of believers out there who think the entire future is in AI, and of course you need hardware, you need a lot of processing power to do that, NVIDIA, as it has been in the past, is right in the thick of it all. It's like anybody in the high-tech business who wants to be in AI uses NVIDIA components. So they've been geniuses, really, as far as... there's a long lead time on this hardware they develop, but they've developed it in such a way that it creates an absolute necessity for the whole AI world to be NVIDIA's customers, even other companies that sell into that. You know, it's not even a niche, it's a big deal. So the stock is, it's been split pretty much, but it's at 147 as we speak, and I don't know where the top is, really. I'm looking at the monthly chart, and certainly everything in the longer-term charts is upward. There's no extrapolating a good top or even an end to all the insanity. So I don't know. It's but it's going to take a while, really, for AI to seven out on disappointment. It's only speaking as a writer, and I do pay $12 a month for Grammarly just to flag typos and things like that. But speaking as a writer, I can tell when something has been written by AI because it's completely lacking in imagination. It's competent as far as the grammar and usage are concerned, but there's nothing to it. And for that reason, and that's really a big plus for customers like Disney, which has not had a creative idea of its own in 50 years. So you're going to see more movies that are scripted by AI. The actors who appear in them will be AI generated. You can have Marlon Brando films again. But whoever the talent is in these AI films, they're going to be crap films. The AI is not capable of writing a good poem. It's not capable of painting a good painting. It just doesn't have it in it, and I don't think it ever will. I think the human spark is something that will always evade not just the programmers, but the learning programs, the algorithms that keep learning and learning and learning. And even if it learns to create a work of art that it knows will sell, it's going to lack something that will eventually catch up with that art form. So what spooked me, really, I was watching a MTV documentary on Eric Clapton, and it was a pretty interesting documentary, but some younger person, I'm sure, in MTV's creative department thought, well, let's give it something interesting. Let's create visual analogs for Eric Clapton's music. So initially, the first 10 or 15, 20 seconds of it was interesting. They streamed something that in your mind you could imagine corresponded to the music itself. It looked like a visual analog for Eric Clapton music. But after 15 or 20 seconds, and this documentary went on for, I think, 2 hours, you could puke, really, watching what some algorithm decided was a visual, streaming visual, that expressed the feeling of Eric Clapton's music. It was good for 10 or 15 seconds, but after, 2 hours, I tuned it out before then, and I just realized this endless stream of mindless visuals was just AI crap. So AI is capable of no more than crap in all fields that relate to the arts. It absolutely cannot write a good poem. And it may be able to fool some people with an AI poem, but I can assure you it won't be a good poem.
Yeah, when you can predict what they're going to say in a movie, he's going to say, yeah, that's what I expected, and then that's what they say. That's an AI-written show.
Yeah, and it's more and more, it's going to happen more and more, and so that's really the pathway for AI. It's just simply to eliminate jobs, work a day, paralegals who turn out boilerplate, ostensibly creative types who do pseudo-creative things, but that's all going to be done by machine, and I'm not quite sure where the people who are doing those jobs now are going to find employment, but AI is definitely a job killer, and that's its primary purpose right now. They're good things. Don't get me wrong. There's an AI based gun. It's a little cannon that shoots bullets at drones. And it winds up being a very effective way, a cost-effective way of knocking small drones out of the sky, because the turret can be so with AI locking on to targets, you can shoot these things down literally with two rounds. You don't even have to waste more bullets than that, and so that's a terrific, I think, advancement of AI. That will help defeat our enemies, who are more and more heading in that asymmetrical direction of sending drones at aircraft carriers and whatever. The carrier groups, they use something called a phalanx one of the words in this cannon is phalanx, but it costs a lot. It's a big machine. I think it weighs, 15,000 pounds or something. And the little AI turret thing can be mounted on a truck. So I say bravo for AI for figuring out a cheap way to defeat enemies of ours who are increasingly using drones.
Gold, what's the picture going to be there?
Well, I think I mentioned I had a target up at 2803 basis the December, and I started drum rolling it back in September when gold was $300 lower. And as it got closer, I said, look, I told my subscribers to be really careful up around 2803. And it got to 2801.40, and now since then, a few weeks ago, gold is down almost $300. So whenever one of my hidden pivot targets catches an important swing like that, I always allow for the possibility that that's it, that that's the end of the gold bull market. I don't know. I'm also flexible enough to allow for a new record high. If it goes above 2803, the next target where you should look for trouble is 2940. That would be basis December COMEX. So all I can say about gold is maybe it's seen a top, but I'll leave it open. I'll leave open the possibility that it will reverse and take out 2803. But usually, if that happens, the telltale sign of a trend continuing is that each ABCD pattern reaches its D target. But when the corrective patterns, the ones going the other way, start reaching or exceeding their D targets, it means that the downtrend, in this case in gold, will continue. And that's what I'm seeing right now. I'm seeing at this point, corrective rallies are not getting past the midpoint of their CD leg. So that's a very reliable and accurate indicator, and it allows me to detect really small changes in gold. In other words, to be sort of right on top of it on the 5-minute bar chart when gold is about to make a turn, because any major turn in the price of anything that I track is going to happen first on the lesser charts. So even applies to a bull market that's been going since 2009 in stocks. The bear market is an absolute certainty to begin with a little ABCD pattern on the 1-minute chart that exceeds its D target. So although I can't tell you that in that situation that we've just had the mother of all tops, I can get you short from within a few ticks of the top, and we'll let the question of how far this downtrend is going to run sort itself out.
Where's crude going?
Down, other than for transitory geopolitical reasons that caused the price of crude to spike. You know, the marginal buyer, the country that really holds sway in pricing crude, China, is not exactly in a manufacturing boom. So crude's price, to the extent that it's remained resilient, that's really because of the geopolitical risks. And you can see when the geopolitical risks spike for like 10 hours, as they did when there appeared to be a possibility that Israel would take out Iran's oil production, natural gas production, with an airstrike. Well, crude shot up like crazy. It went ballistic but not even for 2 days. And then when it was ostentatiously announced by the Biden administration that he'd extracted from the Israelis a promise that they weren't going to attack Iran's energy production fields, its facilities, the price of crude came down just as fast as it had shot up. So it's really, the stresses in crude are really from things, geopolitical things that are unknowable. But I think if it were all simply organic supply and demand, crude would be in a in a more pronounced downtrend.
Anything else we should be keeping a close eye on right now?
Yeah, my friend Sean. Next time we talk, I'll see you. I'll let you know what he's been doing, but I don't see how you can opt out of 4% in treasuries now. There's just no excuse for being in a market, no matter how much higher it has to go. And, of course, treasuries have been endlessly downtrending, but, of course, sooner or later they're going to make a turn. And I've already explained why, even with interest rates low, it's not an interest rate play. It's a capital gains play to be in treasuries. So we'll see. Everything seems to be stacked against U.S. treasuries, and you wonder where all the bullish buying is going to be coming from. But the most logical place would be from a troubled world. So we're definitely in a troubled world. Interesting times, as the saying goes. And that gives me this idea that the bonds are not too far off a bottom, or it's possible they already have bottomed.
Rick, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Well, thanks much for inviting me on, Jim. It is always a pleasure.
My guest has been Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website rickackerman.com. If you have any questions for Rick or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on X at How Street. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.